Hi, it's Lisa Z from RCP. Today we are discussing the amazing finale of the Netflix docuseries, The Keepers. We wanted to let you know that during this session, Laura's internet in London went out, so the best we could do in the situation was have her call in and record her on her phone. So the sound quality of Laura's track isn't what we hoped for, however, the content of our discussion will definitely make up for that. Thanks for understanding, and now let's get back to episode 7 of The Keepers.
The Archdiocese had an opportunity. Back in 1992, 93, 94, to do the right thing and to help not just me, but I am sure many other Catholics to know that they were not alone. And instead, I still feel very alone.
The fact that the Catholic Church has taken on the role as not only being the abuser, but also the savior, it's a dichotomy they can't explain. You cannot lay those side by side.
So I would say a 6 o'clock mass or a 7 o'clock mass, and I'd have to I'd ride my bicycle down. That's where I met Father Maslow for the first time. Really got to started to know the fella. By November of my 8th grade, he was driving me home. He said, put the bike in the trunk, I'm gonna drive you home. And we'd stop for a snowball. I was the golden boy. I could do no wrong.
Hello and welcome to Real Crime Profile. This is Jim Clementi, former New York City prosecutor, retired FBI profiler, and writer-producer on CBS's Criminal Minds, as well as co-creator of Manhunt, the Unabomber. So with me today from London is...
Laura Richards, criminal behavioral analyst, former New Scotland Yard, and founder and director of Paladin National Stalking Advocacy Service.
And I'm Lisa Zambetti. I'm the casting director for Criminal Minds, where Jim Clementi is my colleague. And we have just finished casting Jim's episode. Yay!
Yeah.
It's such a great opportunity to work together in a very different way than we do on the podcast.
Yeah, it's episode 1306 called Lucky Strikes. And it is kind of a flipping of the script here, isn't it? Because I'm sort of working in your bailiwick when we're casting, and you work in mine and Laura's when we're doing Real Crime Profile. So
right.
It's a great crossover, and we have put together an amazing cast. I really can't wait, and it really is amazing because based on the name, I think it'll be a little bit of a spoiler, but Lucky Strikes, and... sure, you'll be able to figure it out.
And you're a longtime listener,
yes.
A longtime viewer. One thing I want to share with the listener is how delightful it is to see a different side of Jim when we're in casting, because he's just, not that he's not a joy to be with here on the podcast, but he's so just happy and his face just lights up when he hears his words read and he cries. Can I say that? Is
don't
that okay?
Cry,
is that
really,
well, but... he wrote some very moving scenes. And so when the actors come in to audition, you know, I'm very hard nosed, like, okay. And then I look over at Jim and he's a little teary.
But it's hard when, I mean, these people come in off the street and all of a sudden they have to turn on the tears and be very emotional. And it's really draining. You can tell it takes something out of them. And so I really feel for them. And so, but that's when you know that it's going to be great when it comes on screen.
Yeah. So anyway, so that was really fun to do this week.
Here we are for our finale episode of The Keepers. And what a finale it was, huh, Lisa?
Yeah. We begin this episode 7 called Conclusion, with a real curveball. After all this time, they really kind of buried the lead with introducing us to this man, Charles Franz, who, Laura, do you want to talk about Charles and his story?
Yeah, I mean, like you said, it was a real, curveball that we learned that Maskell had previously been abusing boys, and in particular this altar boy called Charles Franz. And he sort of starts by describing himself as the golden boy in the class that was picked out by Maskell and plied with alcohol and drugs and wine from the chalice and coerced through fear. Maskell said that he would make his life a misery if he was talking about him. And so he went along with things for a while. But he did, in fact, tell his mother, and, you know, fair play to his mom, he went straight up the school and made it clear what Maskell was doing and told the church to deal with it properly. And so that was back in 1967, wasn't it? So right. Way before his transfer to Keogh, which, of course, we learn about Jean and Jane Doe. And, you know, I think Ryan White, as you said, Lisa, has done a fantastic job here. And I can't remember whether we did cover this, but it was Ryan White's aunt who went to school at Keogh, wasn't it, with Jean and Jane Doe. And I'm not sure whether we mentioned that before, but she kind of gave Ryan White the story. And, you know, it just keeps unfolding, doesn't it? It really is just every time you think it can't get any worse, well, guess what? It does.
Right. And the thing about Charles Franz is that he, unlike the vast majority of victims who delay disclosure for many years, in fact, the average is 20 years and 25% wait till 30 years to disclose against priests, he actually disclosed pretty much in the midst of it and was summarily shut down by Father Maskell. And here's the thing. A lot of people may have been shocked by the fact that Maskell could have molested all these girls from Keogh and have molested boys, or at least this boy, before that. And we found in our studies at the Behavioral Analysis Unit that there is a high degree of crossover, that offenders, preferential offenders who were sexually attracted to children, will also cross genders and age lines based on availability and vulnerability. And because of that, they're a risk to both boys and girls. And it really appears to me that because Charles Franz came forward, because his mother went to the Archdiocese and complained and told them they have to do something about it, because of that, what they did, instead of taking him out of the priesthood, going to the police about it, doing something to specifically protect children from that point forward, they swept it under the rug and they put him in a school that was all girls. And they believed, well, we did our job. He can't molest anybody else because we're only giving him access to girls. Well, obviously, that was fundamentally and absurdly wrong. And now there is a trail of destruction after Father Maskell went through so many girls at Keogh.
Yeah, I mean, this is really the tip of the tragedy. If they had arrested him or put him away, there would be no murder of Kathy Sesnick. There would not be this trail of tears and horror that was left. And, you know, and I'm so glad that he was taken away from St. Clemens, because he certainly would have molested more boys, don't you think,
Yeah,
Jim?
Absolutely. And here's the thing. I mean, this is actually around the same time period that the offender that offended against me, Michael J. O'Hara, where he was teaching in Catholic schools and coaching at Catholic schools and running Catholic camps. This is the same exact time period. And his offenses were also at the exact same time being swept under the rug by the Archdiocese of New York. So the Archdiocese of Baltimore was not alone in this. And there were many hundreds of victims between these two offenders. And the Catholic Church had an opportunity to stop them early. Because I remember when I was at the camp, that three of the boys that I was at the camp with, three of them, one day just disappeared. And I remember the director, who was the offender, said, oh, their parents just think they're better than everybody else, so they took their kids out of this camp. Well, I am certain that's not why the parents took their kids out of the camp. I'm certain it was because the parents found out what happened. And like Charles Franz's mother, they probably went to the Archdiocese instead of going to the police. Because back then, as a Catholic, you didn't go to the police against the Catholic Church. You didn't go to the police against a priest who's in such an exalted position, or a Catholic school teacher who was part of the church, who actually had been in the seminary, as the offender who offended against me was, but he was kicked out of the seminary. And yet he was still allowed to teach at Catholic schools and coach Catholic school boys and run their camp.
Yeah, the other thing that about this that just I became so incensed about, I mean, just completely felt so angry about it, was the fact that we found out that it was the same individual who had dealt with both Charles France back in the day and also with Jean. And, you know, we find out that Charles France and his mother had actually spoken with Monsignor Francis Malouli about the abuse, and he had also written the letter to in the Keogh case, basically saying that he wanted to protect other people, and that was in 1993. So he was the person that knew everything, and yet there was zero accountability. And I think, you know, they could get out of it by saying, well, we didn't keep the records or we didn't know about it, but this one individual, Monsignor Francis Malouli, is the one person that joins it all together, and he's now in fact the Bishop of Wilmington. So, and when he was approached, he did confirm that he had met with Charles back in the 1960s, but he said, and this is an inverted commas, that it was for counseling and spiritual assistance, which was nothing for what it truly was about. So you've got a clear lack of accountability here, and that's the part that I just find absolutely unconscionable.
Yeah, and when you say the letter, Laura, these are the letters that...
The letter sent out by the Archdiocese in 1993 to people, saying to people to come forward, and it was their intention to protect people, to protect others, and it was signed by this Monsignor Malouli, who is now the Bishop of Wilmington.
Right, but these were the letters that Jean's family sent out asking for people to come forward and asking any alumni of Keogh to come forward. And, you know, and this guy sends a letter saying, oh, yes, you know, let us know. And this guy already knew. He already fucking knew.
And the emphasis was on Jean to find more people. They're already sat on that. That's exactly why I'm just so fucking angry about it. He knew the barefaced lie. And he was just covering up the whole thing. And he's still acting, you know, in the capacity of a bishop. Which, how can that be right?
Yeah, right. And to meet with Charles Franz years later and say, okay, what do you want? You want a boat? What do you need? You know, we will give you anything you want if you just shut up and do not corroborate what you know. And that is just disgusting.
It is disgusting. It's, I mean, come on. It's just. It shows you the kind of people they are, the kind of disgusting, deceitful criminals they are. And to me, it's just I just don't understand why anybody can still listen to anything they say and give it some sort of merit. I just believe that they have just violated every rule that they've ever set out for anybody. And just because they think, oh, once you're a priest, you're protected. You're the best in the world. You're basically Jesus Christ on earth, so you can't do any wrong. So they're going to protect anybody from doing anything against children. It's beyond disgusting.
It really is. And when Jean was confronted and told about this in the documentary, you know, she hears about it for the first time, about Charles Franz, and she hears about the fact there was already corroborating evidence and other victims. I mean, I thought her response was incredibly measured. I don't think mine would have been quite so measured, finding out that she had gone through all of that, and yet they'd been sat on all this evidence, and they'd made her feel a liar. You know, they had said that she had made things up, and that she had to go and find all of this evidence. They put her through that court process. She felt like she had lost everything, and yet she then finds out right at the end that they've sat on all of this, and this one individual who holds it all together, who knows the complete picture, has just barefaced lied, not just to her, to Teresa, to all of them. And then, of course, we learn about Ireland and the fact that Maskell actually goes over to Ireland, which I ended up doing a little bit of digging around Ireland. I was quite interested to hear that he had gone there across the period. I think it was he was actually in Wexford April the 11th, 1995 to November the 7th, 1995. He was actually working and employed as a psychologist, which is quite unbelievable.
Yeah, weren't they sending victims to him?
Yep, that's exactly what they were doing. He was in a psychoeducation initiative, or he was running it, for the Southeastern Health Board in Wexford. And he went to Ireland because his father was from there, from Limerick originally. So he goes over and works for the health service executive. And he, at this point, there's a suggestion that he was defrocked, but he ended up actually, even though he wasn't meant to be, he did give mass. And some of the locals complained about it because obviously he's an American rocking up in quite a small place and give it, you know, he's the one holding mass and people start asking questions about him. He's actually using his name, Anthony. So he was christened Anthony. That was his first name. And Joseph, I believe, is his middle name. So he went by the name of Anthony Maskell.
To try to hide.
To try and hide. He understood the system, as we know. And we also, certainly I found out that he also had a police radio and scanner and, you know, paid close attention to the police. And, of course, his brother was in the police too. So he obviously feels he can go over to Ireland and, you know, change his name and hide as such and do what the hell he wanted to. But actually he was held to account on that. And he actually had, the health executive said that it was a temporary and short employment with them. It was 7 months. And yes, children were referred to him. It was children and those children who had been sexually abused before.
Oh my God.
I know. You just can't make this up. He ended up then working privately and carried on working, I believe, still with children, but no longer for the health service executive. And it's ironic, actually, that he went to Wexford. I don't know if it is a coincidence that they had a big sexual abuse scandal there themselves with a number of priests. And in fact, Jim, you'd be interested in this, that one individual who was a victim, someone called Colm O'Gorman, he basically came forward about his abuse by a priest in 1995. There were 21 counts. Of a number of priests actually who were abusing children, and one of them was Colm O'Gorman, who now I believe is the head of Amnesty International in Ireland.
Wow.
So there were a number of people coming forward all at the same time. So was it a coincidence that Maskell goes over to that particular part of Ireland,
or did they welcome him?
Yeah, right. It's like a summer camp for pedophiles.
Well, speaking of summer camp, this you should know as well. I talked to one of the lawyers who has been working in Baltimore for a number of years, and she said that Maskell was also, before he molested Charles Franz, was also the priest at a boys' camp. And the boys were very young, like 5, 6, 7 years old, and that they believe that he molested at least 40 boys at that camp. And so That preceded Charles Franz, which preceded Keogh, which preceded Sister Kathy's death. I mean, there's so many things that happened because instead of actually dealing with it, I mean, it's very parallel to the case of the guy, Michael J. O'Hara, who molested me and dozens of other boys over the course of 23 years before I was able to get the FBI and the NYPD on his trail, and we actually locked him up. Even for just a short period of time, at least he was a convicted sex offender after that.
It's just so maddening, isn't it? And it's so important for people to understand, you know, that abusers, they do hide in plain sight, and some of them do gravitate towards institutions or jobs where they can fish in pools that give them access to vulnerable people, children and people. And
target-rich environments.
Exactly, target-rich environment. And as you said, Jim, you know, as we know, it's all about opportunity and availability and accessibility, you know, and desirability. And here you have a prime example of an abuser who used an institution but just literally flitted from place to place and country to country and was never truly brought to book at any point.
So as we know, you guys have taught me that these crimes operate in secrecy and shame and in darkness. And so anytime we can bring a candle to it and light up that darkness, I'm just so grateful. And I know, you know, many of our listeners, since we've started this series, have written to us with their own personal tragedies. And I just cannot believe the pain that's out there and the things that have gone on. But I do want to thank our listeners for the support that you've all given to Jim and I for, you know, sharing our stories. And I just feel so, so supported. And I just want to thank each of you, and you know who you are, who've reached out to me. And, you know, keep sending me your stories if you need to do that. You know, that's what I'm here for.
Yeah, thank you for saying that, Lisa, and to both of you for sharing your story. And I just want to encourage those in Ireland to come forward, because I still think there are many who've not had their voice heard, and in particular, you know, with regards to the Catholic Church. And I want to make it absolutely clear, because I've been reading a number of articles over here in The Independent, The Telegraph, and others that have really incensed me, with the Catholic Church talking about children consenting in these situations.
Oh, my God.
And children cannot consent. And that is absolutely clear. You know, this is when people have been talking about compensation claims, trying to say that 12-year-olds had consented, you know, to some of these sexual acts. And it's absolutely outrageous, and it's nonsensical. A child cannot consent.
It's just, it's absolutely outrageous that they would try to hide behind that. And you know, that's exactly the kind of rationalizations that the priests use when they're offending in the first place. And just to have the Catholic Church support that, it's unconscionable. When are you going to be, like, moral? When are you going to do what you say you're supposed to do, Catholic Church? Why are you telling other people they have to be moral and not sin and not do things to hurt other people? And you're telling them that, and then you're doing the opposite. It's just, I just don't believe it. I just don't believe anybody can sit there and let them get away with that crap.
Just to go back to that point, because Charles Franz, you know, said in the documentary, you know, he was asked by this Monsignor Francis Malouli, the now Bishop of Wilmington, and I will keep naming him because he has a name and there should be accountability. He was asked, well, what did he want him to do about it? Did he want a boat? Did he want him to buy him something? And Charles said, no, that's not what I wanted. What it is about is he wanted them to do what is right, to do the right thing. And that's what we're not seeing here. And continuing, and, you know, that part in these articles that I've recently read is, again, absolutely unconscionable and unbelievable. And everybody should be challenging that.
One thing that one of our listeners sent to me was a link to an article about a nun who was arrested for helping five priests rape deaf children. And my response was, you know, there's no hell hot enough for this woman. And, you know, one of our listeners, just to pose the opposite side, said, well, maybe she was somebody who was under their influence and actually groomed to be, you know, basically a pimp for these priests and all that. And I just don't buy it. That's like the just following orders, you know, argument. Mm-hmm. I don't know. What do you think about that, as far as accomplices, nuns being accomplices to these priests?
Why is that person a nun? To follow priest orders or to do good and to help other people? Clearly, following priest orders should not be paramount. Helping people should be. And she has no business being a nun. She has no business being a free citizen if that's what she's going to do. And, you know, to hell with those priests as well. Obviously, it's just, I'm done. I'm so done with those assholes.
Yeah. But we've also got to bear in mind, I mean, Lisa, is this the context of Keo, that this is afterwards that this nun may have witnessed, or is this at the same time as Sister Kathy? What was the context?
The context, you know what, I don't have it all in front of me, but I know that she was arrested for helping. I mean, it's not that she just had knowledge of it, but that she was actually helping the priests.
And so she wasn't just complicit. She was actually physically taking part in it. I mean, the one thing just to point out, and it's probably an obvious thing to say, but if Sister Kathy was murdered and, you know, that culture of fear would permeate, and that's not to excuse her whatsoever.
Sure.
You know, she took, or would have taken, full responsibility for herself in that situation. And of course, the context is really important to understand. I don't know the full details, but I do certainly understand that coercion, and certainly when somebody has been murdered, I would imagine that that sends a very powerful message to people. You know, if there was any whispering that she knew about what had gone on and then she, you know, is taken off and is murdered, that sets a different tone again and probably would terrify most people, the children, the girls who were there, as well as others who didn't really know what to do. But I agree with Jim on the other side, is that it's about standing up, and you have to be accountable in these situations when you are in charge of safeguarding, and children in particular. You are the one that is accountable as an adult. You are put in that responsibility of trust to care for those youngsters and vulnerable people. So you do have to stand up and do the right thing, and that is your duty, as well as their duty to God. They're meant to do the right thing. Add law enforcement into the equation, well, it just gets worse and worse, doesn't it? The very people who are there also who are meant to protect. And of course, we hear that they were very much involved.
And I can imagine that heavy burden on her, because Kathy never said she was going to do something she didn't do. If she told them she was going to make it stop, if that portion of all of this is accurate, all of these girls can't all be telling a lie. Kathy would have been working to make it stop, no doubt in my mind.
So up next in the documentary, we see a very moving scene, at least was for me, where Marilyn, Kathy's sister, and Jerry, Kathy's very close friend, kind of meet up. And I feel like every time somebody sees Marilyn, I feel like they just kind of devour her, because she reminds them so much of Kathy. Because I remember when Gemma, you know, meets Marilyn for the first time and is like, oh, you look just like your sister. I mean, it just feels like whenever they're with her, it's like a touch from Kathy.
Well, it's always great to hear more about the victim and bring them back and learning more, everything we can about them.
So Marilyn shows Jerry the ring that was found on Kathy's hand when her body was discovered, and it was the ring that Jerry gave her. And it just kind of starts to bring back
That's
all these
Jerry
memories.
Koob.
Correct.
Who was Father Koob back then. And obviously, this is one of the scenes in which I believe the emotion that was conveyed was very genuine by Jerry Koob. I don't know how you think about that, Laura.
I would absolutely concur with that. I think he is very authentic and credible in his account of what happened and the real care and certainly high regard that he held Kathy in, I think really does come across.
Yeah, and I know that there are listeners and viewers who think that he is actually a good suspect, that his behavior was strange or weird or whatever, and I just have to disagree. I find him to be incredibly credible, and I think appropriately emotional and appropriately pissed off in the right places. And it's not 100% certain, but I will say that the openness with which he discusses the issues of their relationship and his desire to leave the priesthood and marry her, not commit completely to the priesthood and not have her completely commit to the convent, and so they could get together. I think the fact that he's so open about that is something that actually inures to his benefit.
I would agree with that. I think the authenticity is certainly there. And I still can't get over the scene of him talking about being questioned by the police and, you know, her vagina being thrown on the table to kind of shock him into a reaction. And I still felt that the way he told that particular account, the way that he relayed it, seemed very credible to me, you know, the detail of it and so on and so forth. And the fact, you know, he is married and you meet his wife and you understand his setup. I think all of it, you know, he doesn't present as a suspect to me. Clearly the police thought he was at the time. And, you know, quite rightly, everyone should be looked at and scrutinized, and there should be an open mind about what happened. But unfortunately, they weren't probing in the right places.
I really feel for him, and I really feel like he's one of the ripple effect victims of this tragic case. I believe him when he said that Sister Kathy wanted to talk to him about something very serious. And I believe that it would have been a very serious topic for her to raise with him because of the fact that he was in the priesthood at the time. And so she would be really bucking a system that is heavily weighted toward priests and their authority in the church. And so that would be a big thing for her to raise with him. And it could have affected their relationship. So that's a risk that she wanted to take. And she was probably marshaling her emotions and her case to present to him.
And I saw a lot of very horrible things written online about him. You know, people talking about him being a suspect. And there was a real backlash online about him. And his son actually weighed in. About that this documentary has had on all of them. And see, when people do take part in these things, majority of people do it for the right reasons. They want to get a voice and they want to get to the truth and to justice. But of course, there can be a backlash, and his family, unfortunately, have suffered some significant hatred and abuse online because people do believe that he was a suspect.
Right, and I agree. It's outrageous that people do that. The fact is that he participated in this because he wants this case resolved, because he still has that incredibly strong emotional bond to Kathy and her memory, and he feels he owes her this. And I think that especially when you read the letters from her to him that they exposed in this documentary, it shows that they have a very loving, balanced relationship. And the fact that they may not have kept their vows 100% in the process because they fell in love, but in the end, that Kathy still wanted to maintain her life with the convent and her commitment there. And he ended up doing the same, at least for a long time afterwards. Just tells me that he is not involved in her death in any way, shape, or form. There is no other witness that ties them at all. And I know people make a lot of, well, did he really have an alibi? And why didn't he call the police right away? Well, because he had no idea that she was dead. He had no idea. I mean, he did what was in his toolbox, which was he said a mass. You know, he wanted God to intercede and made sure she was okay, but he was concerned about her. But as soon as they found some sort of evidence that there was foul play, which was the car parked, you know, cattywankle across the entrance and in a wrong place, and the door open and mud on the tires and sticks and things sticking around inside the car, that obviously immediately got him to call the police. So I just don't buy that he's a suspect at all. And I'm glad that he was ruled out by the cops. And I do not believe that the viewing audience that believes that he should still be a suspect, I do not believe that they're correct.
And some true crime fans, even on podcasts I've listened to, have said because the police felt that he was guilty, therefore he is. But he did claim he never knew anything about the sexual abuse going on in the school until the 1994 hearings. And of course, that night, she did call him. And as we said before, she possibly was going to confide in him that evening. And somebody who I feel did know much more is Sister Russell.
Exactly, and, yeah.
Yeah, she was much more of interest, which, of course, sadly, I mean, she left the convent, she got married, had children, but she wouldn't speak about what she knew. And she took, you know, the secrets of the things that she did know to her grave.
Right. And, you know, and she was in much the same position as Kathy. And as they presented in the documentary, Father Maskell and Father Magnus both showed up at their apartment on the night before Kathy went missing. They were very irate. And it's in all likelihood, this was a precursor to Kathy getting killed. So her roommate was also a nun, and her roommate was also within the church, and her roommate was also a woman, and she may have shut her mouth because Kathy was killed. It was a very effective way of keeping her quiet, just like it was used to keep Jane Doe quiet and many of the other girls probably.
It seems like a lot of Sister Russell's friends did think she had a story to tell and that someday it would come out. That seems to be what people instinctually thought, but nope, it never came out. And unfortunately, I mean, I don't want to blame anybody for this, but she definitely had the keys to probably putting Maskell away. And
you don't know. She may have had the keys, but you don't know. She may have actually gone to the Archdiocese. She may have actually done something about it. We don't know because, well, what did the Archdiocese do with all the evidence they knew in this case, with all the allegations? They swept them under the rug. So I can't say we should put blame on Sister Russell. But obviously, she was affected by the death of Sister Kathy, and who knows whether she may have conveyed it to somebody else. She may have written out her story. It may surface at some point, and hopefully we will get to know what was in her mind.
I think it just seems bittersweet that when she found out that Maskell had died, and she, I guess, by all reports, made a cryptic statement that he went to his grave with his secrets, why she didn't feel free at that time to tell her story. But she didn't. She died 2 days later, so.
Well, she had cancer as well, though, didn't she? She had cancer and had surgery. So, you know, again, ill health and, you know, being very poorly herself, that could have, you know, really weighed in here as well.
I don't think she is one of the evil ones in this situation. And for example, the principal who told Maskell, you have 15 minutes to leave the school, I think she's much more responsible. When you're talking about a young, early 20-something nun versus the principal of the school versus the priest versus the Archdiocese of Baltimore and all the administrators and the lawyers and the bishops and the monsignors that made decisions that swept this case under the rug, I do not believe that Sister Russell was high on the list of culpability here.
No, and I don't think, you know, evil's the right word to attach to her or to others. I think it's people, you know, much more likely making bad choices and bad decisions about things. And of course, there are people that were, you know, that would have been exposed as well. So some of it is conscious, some of it is unconscious, some of it's through fear and trying to keep themselves safe. I have no doubt about that. But I do think there are a lot of people who knew far more. And, you know, as we know, the truth eventually does a ways out, but it's the time scale of it, isn't it? How long it takes and when it happens. You know, she may well have told her husband, Sister Russell, she may well have told her children there could be legacies passed on. And of course, I still think we've got much more to come on this case in particular.
Laura, do you want to skip ahead now to Joyce and the Malachy family?
I mean, we do talk about Kathy a lot, and I do feel that Joyce doesn't assume as much significance in everybody's conversations, actually, not just the documentary. I just mean in terms of, you know, generally that, you know, she did have, or Maskell had close proximity to her. She was in his congregation, wasn't she? And she disappears in very similar circumstances in a very short space of time when Kathy goes missing. And of course, we learn at this stage that the FBI actually had jurisdiction of the investigation because the body was found on a military base. However, Tom Nugent, we go back to sort of the start of the dogged investigative journalist. He looks into this case and he found out that the FBI said that they didn't actually investigate it. And so you've got this whole mismatch of local police that they handed the case over to the FBI, the FBI saying that they didn't investigate it and they didn't have records of the case. And so therefore it appears that actually no one law enforcement body actually ever investigated this murder. I mean, what do you think about that, Jim?
It just sounds like a clusterfuck. I mean, it sounds like
unbelievable.
They were kind of involved, and we know we saw the was it the county police chief? Was that who it was in the documentary who talks about, well, we had a lot of other things we were working on, and, you know, it was just one of the cases, and it really wasn't that important to him, basically. So, you know, I agree. I don't think anybody actually fully investigated this case. And it's outrageous because you have two young women killed within the space of a few days and very similar in terms of victimology. And yet they're not somehow linked. They're not somehow investigated as a serial case. And I think when they say that there was no link determined between them, that wasn't right, was it, Lisa?
No, it wasn't. I mean, there's a lot of links. I think we've already discussed, but it's just staggering to me. Nobody is taking responsibility for this case. Why? Why is that? Nobody wants to put their hands on this. It's just stunning to me. You have this entire family clamoring to find out who killed their sister, and nobody fucking cares. And they're just pointing the fingers at this one, that one, the other agency. Come on.
Well, I mean, and it may have something to do with the fact that the main suspect in Sister Kathy's death happens to be a priest who is a chaplain for the police department. And who has a brother who's in the police department and who has many police connections and National Guard connections and all this other stuff. So, I mean, it may be that somebody deliberately swept it under the rug and did not get involved in the investigation or did not cooperate between the investigations. And that's why both of them remain unsolved to this day.
But, you know, it's what you say, Jim. Is it something that is a conscious thing that's happened here, that it's convenient to kind of forget about it and actually it's gone into the too difficult basket? Or is it this, you know, complete fuck up between two organizations that they both think the other is doing it? So how much of it is conscious, how much of it is unconscious? But I think the next part is interesting in that when they are asked, the FBI in particular, and I think it's an FOIA request, isn't it? A Freedom of Information request. And I believe it was first submitted in 2014, there wasn't a reply. And in April 2016, there was a follow-up to it, another Freedom of Information request. Now, I certainly know at New Scotland Yard and here in the UK, we have to reply within a certain time frame. Someone has to reply. And I would, you know, I don't like to make any assumptions, but no doubt there's something similar in place in the US for different law enforcement agencies. But to have no reply in 2014, then no reply in 2016, and then there to be a reply saying that the FBI was saying that they had 4,000 pages on this case, but that it's sort of awaiting a review, and it seems you know, it's gone into this kind of bureaucratic nightmare where nothing's been happening, and then the documentary coming out, it seems to have galvanized them into some form of action. So at least now is being done, because a number of murders are being looked at. I believe it's actually 9 unsolved homicides which are being looked at. So at least there's some action now, but it's too little too late, is it not?
Yeah. Well, here's the thing. In answer to your question, Laura, the FBI generally does not investigate homicides. They're not the boots-on-the-ground homicide investigators that local police departments are. But if there's a homicide on a government reservation, like a military base or even, you know, in a Native American reservation, then or a national park, then the FBI gets involved. So it's possible that the FBI sort of deliberately took a back seat because there was another probably related abduction homicide very close nearby. And so they may have taken a back seat in this investigation, thinking that the locals were going to do it, not knowing that the locals were actually tied into one of the main suspects of that investigation. So it could have just fallen through the cracks. But the fact that they have 4,000 pages on it now, it may be that they ordered the file from the local investigators. I just can't imagine that the FBI did investigation that amounted to 4,000 pages.
I don't know anything. That sounds like a lot. I mean, what is in there if there's that amount of discovery or whatever it is?
I don't know. I'm sure that that's interviews and forensics and autopsy reports and anything else that would be relevant to a case. But I don't think that it was something that the FBI put a lot of effort into, but that could have just been because it was a homicide, and they looked at it as a single homicide on a government reservation. So it wasn't such a huge priority because she wasn't from the military base. Her body was just found there, and that could mean that they felt that the entire investigation was going to be off the base, and therefore there's no reason for them to be doing the investigation, and it could have just, again, fallen through the cracks because of that.
There is a police report indicating that when Sister Sesnik went missing, we have an eyewitness that saw a male driver driving Sister Sesnik's vehicle from the scene. It appeared as though Sister Sesnik was trying to exit the vehicle on the passenger side, but she never got out of the vehicle.
I think it's interesting now that, you know, there was some comment that it awaits specialist processing. I mean, what the hell does that mean?
All right, well, I think what it means is that somebody, that the FBI gets hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of FOIA requests, and they have specialists who look through it to see if there's anything that's law enforcement sensitive or classified. And because they deal with so many cases that have those kinds of things, every single document that they release has to go through that at FBI headquarters in order for the FOIA request to be answered. And I believe they probably just, they didn't put any kind of priority on it because it is, you know, in their mind, just another homicide case. And unfortunately, that means that it could take years for somebody to actually review it and answer the FOIA request. But I do think there are rules as to the fact that they have to answer within a certain amount of time. But whether they have to do the specialist evaluation within a certain amount of time, I don't know.
Right. And, you know, maybe it's something to do with the fact that there are, you know, apparently 5 other women that have been murdered that are unsolved. I think it's 9 in total. I read an article on. So, you know, it sounds like there's a little bit of work to be done there. You know, are there other cases that are linked? It certainly sounds like Joyce and Kathy from what we do know about those cases, but it sounds like there are a number of others that are also being looked at in, you know, conjunction with each other, and quite rightly too.
I've had a couple of questions to ask you both that have kind of been burning a hole in my brain. Do you think there is any world where these murders are from a serial killer that has nothing to do with the school abuse, that Kathy and Joyce, and it sounds like several others, were murdered and it could have nothing to do, it was a coincidence that Kathy was connected to the sexual abuse? And my follow-up question is, do you think there's any chance that Joyce was a murder done as a forensic countermeasure to throw the scent off of the sexual abuse and make it seem like Kathy was a victim of a serial killer?
Well, I would say that an unrelated serial killer would mean that somehow, you know, out of some bizarre coincidence, that it happened just after the time where Maskell confronted Sister Kathy in an angry manner in her apartment, and that somehow Maskell had information about where her body was and took Jane Doe there to see it and used it as a method of control. So I'd say that's an outrageous, you know, possibility. Is there some universe where that could have happened? Possibly, but I do not think it is anywhere near a probability. I think that if Father Maskell used the body of Sister Kathy to control Jane Doe, then I believe that he had either a hand in actually killing her, or he was working in conjunction with the person who actually killed her.
Well, the only excuse I can say is that if he's as close to the police as we think he is, if she was one in a series of murders and he knew that she'd been killed, that somehow he knew that he could leverage that. I know it's far-fetched.
But
I'm
then,
just sort of
then
trying
that
to...
would mean that would mean that the police knew about where her body was and left it there for a given amount of time so that he could use that to his advantage and control. And I just don't think that's possible. I mean, as disgusting and as corrupt as some police officers appear to be who were actually engaging in sexual victimization of Jane Doe and other girls at the school, I don't believe that could have happened if they actually had already found the body.
Yeah, I think a lot of people had a lot to lose in this case. And you know, with Jean Doe, or sorry, I should just call her Jean, with Jean and also others, there is information and intelligence that exists that other victims were taken to either Cathy's body or other female bodies. So if there are other people who were also taken to those bodies, you know, who was that by? Was it by Maskell or by the other priest? And they all know. And it doesn't necessarily mean that Maskell was the person who actually killed Cathy, and I don't believe that he actually did, but I think it was all part of the same network, if you like, or if you will. And, you know, what are the chances of that? It's probably 1% that it's a possibility that this was just, they were random acts and they were not connected, but I would put that in the 1%, and you always have to think about that. But I think victimology tells us it's much more that this was something that was targeted, and you know that it was probably serial. And I think those 9 other unsolved homicides have to be looked at very closely, because what I certainly do know through all my years, 20 years of profiling dangerous individuals who get away with it, is that they continue their behavior and they escalate their behavior and they continue doing it until they are stopped. And so whoever this individual or individuals were, they continued to get away with it. So those other cases need to be looked at incredibly closely. And, you know, I sort of like the end of the documentary where we see, you know, the tree in memory and appreciation of Cathy. I would have liked to have seen that for Joyce and the other victims too, and talking about, you know, facing your fears. And I think the documentary maker, they did a great job with this. But I do think it's tip of the iceberg, and if any of those individuals are still alive, they should be brought to account.
And do you think that Joyce could have been killed as a forensic countermeasure to throw the scent off of the sex abuse angle of it, so that nobody would connect the sexual abuse to Cathy's murder? I mean, could she have been just such a pawn? Joyce could have been such a pawn in this larger game.
Well, it's a high stakes thing, and we have to think about proximity. You know, Maskell, she was in the congregation, Maskell's congregation. He was on one of the sympathy cards. You know, this is an individual who is clearly, you know, a serial perpetrator. He thinks things through. He's somebody who's very manipulative. He understands police procedure. He is a wannabe cop, in my opinion, or was. And, you know, his brother was in the police too. And, you know, I just think we have a network here. It's a very high-stakes thing to do something, you know, to abduct and murder a young woman who's in, you know, a high risk situation as a way of pushing attention elsewhere. And it does look, and of course, you know, Jim and I haven't seen the crime scene pictures and so on and so forth. Dr. Verna Spitz, you know, whose judgment I do trust, and I believe you do too, Jim, you know, when she was talking about Cathy, gave a very clear picture of what had happened to her, but we still don't really know whether there was a sexual assault of any description. We know that clothing was pulled up, and the same with Joyce. So it's difficult to say. And those other 9 unsolved homicides, you know, we'd need to know more about those in terms of whether they are potentially linked, because you could have, you know, someone or individuals acting together, and this, you know, being a serial this is a serial sense that you've got boys who are victimized, girls who are victimized, and there's an escalation to murder. And I don't think that you can ignore that.
Yeah. So at this point, you know, Jean is coming up to present day. She's taking care of her own mother, who seems to, you know, be ailing and perhaps have dementia. And gosh, something Jean says about how she's bitter about her mom not being there when she was abused, and she blames Maskell for taking away a right to a deep and trusting relationship with her mother. Oh,
I can definitely relate to that. I mean, the asshole who victimized me did the same thing, because my mother knew something was wrong, and she tried to get me to talk about it, but all that did was make me push her away further, because I didn't want to tell her, because I was so shamed and I felt so guilty about it, and I felt like she would judge me, that it would be horrible, and that it would kill her, and all these things. And so I was trying to protect her from all that, as I was trying to protect myself from the ramifications of all that. And because of that, we had a distant and strained relationship. And then my mother got cancer and died.
Oh,
and that was never
God.
Resolved.
Oh, my God. I'm
and
so
And I
sorry.
Remember, you know, vividly when I walked into the registrar's office at Fordham Law School and saw Michael J. O'Hara sitting there at the desk, sitting right next to the alumni files. So he had all the information he wanted on me available to him. And him saying to me, oh, yeah, I realized you graduated from here a couple of years ago. And then him saying to me, and yeah, I was sorry to hear about your mother's death. Like, he was following me. He knew all this stuff about me, which would, you know, later be confirmed by when we did a search of his house. We found files that he kept on all his victims. But anyway, it's a disgusting ramification. And I can definitely relate to how Gene feels about the fact that the offender created this rift in her own relationship with her family and her mother, and I'm sure affected her relationship with her husband and her kids as well. And that's something that is one of those long-term ripple effects that can be dealt with, can be resolved, but it creates a lot of turmoil in the lives of survivors, and it's just... It's just another reason why the people that offend against children are, you know, despicable.
They take so much, don't they? They rob childhood as well as relationships with people. And that's why it's just, you know, preying on the vulnerable and robbing years is just so terribly sad. And like you said, Jim, you know, he'd done his homework and, you know, was sat there with the file in that power and control paradigm as well. It just, you know, makes my blood boil. It really does.
Gene and some of the other survivors were able to get through mediation some little pittance of compensation for what they suffered through. I don't know. You know, I mean, I'm glad that they got something and that there was an acknowledgement of a crime. But I think the bigger question that comes near the end of the documentary is this bill to extend the statute of limitations on child sex abuse. Did you guys want to weigh in on that at all? We see C.T. Wilson trying and trying and trying to get this freaking bill voted on. And my jaw dropped when I saw the public hearings and how that fucking lawyer from the Archdiocese shows up again and has the balls to sit there. And I mean, do you remember what I'm talking about? These scenes?
Yeah, it's disgusting and it's reprehensible. And it's exactly why I blame the church for this, not just the individuals in it, but the church making this concerted effort to prevent people from coming forward, from having their voice, from being able to tell their stories and to get justice for what happened to them. It's just, this has to stop. It just has to stop.
I don't know if you remember that scene where all of the survivors are testifying, you know, trying to beg the government to, you know, extend the statute of limitations. So when people do come forward, you know, 20, 30 or more years later, they can get justice. And I couldn't believe Teresa Lancaster, you know, sitting there watching the same lawyer who went after her in the 90s is still there and has absolutely no shame about what he's done.
Right. And I think, correct me if I'm wrong, is the statute of limitations is 3 years that people have to come forward and report abuse.
Did you say 3 years? I thought it was 7 years, something
well,
like
there's
that?
Well, it depends on the severity of the crime. There are 3, 5, and 7 year statutes in some places. And since then, some statutes have been extended. And sometimes now it's 3 years after you remember it, or 3 years after you turn 18, or when you reach 25. It radically depends on the jurisdiction and whether it's a local crime or a federal crime. All those things affect the statute of limitations. The fact is that based on the statistics, there should never be a statute of limitations for child sex crimes because they're children, because they cannot command their worlds the way adults do when it happens, and because there's so much shame and guilt and victim blaming in this, that they should not have to worry about the statute of limitations. It should be something that should survive forever, and until they do that, we're never going to get to the bottom of how many cases are out there because so many cases are unaddressed.
Right. And I think, you know, we know through research that people do come forward much later on, and normally it's in their, you know, the third or fourth decade of life. Certainly, you know, if there are, they are child victims, and it tends to be once they are in a secure and stable and safe place, as we saw with Jean. So, you know, any statute of limitation, any timescale that you have, actually, you know, is a major problem in these cases. So I think that's something that really does need to be looked at. We have the same over here, different timescales and in different pieces of legislation. And the same with stalking, actually. You know, on the Section 2A, there's a time window as well. And it takes, it's a very brave step for someone to come forward and report these things. And then, you know, as we talked about right at the start, and to be able to talk to law enforcement about the worst thing that has happened to you, it takes a huge amount from somebody. And I think, you know, it really does need to be looked at. Certainly from what I had read, it said in particular in relation to this, it was a 3-year time window, which makes no sense at all.
No, and I think what's worse is that, as C.T. Wilson says, that it was actually the church who put pressure on these government officials, you know, totally breaching the church-state separation so that it never even got put up for a vote. I think fortunately now, I think in the years since the documentary was made, I think they actually have been able to pass a bill that extends the statute of limitations. But I mean, that should never, ever happen. There should not be this external pressure on our state officials to protect us. Well, guys, how do you want to wrap up this very emotional series?
I guess probably giving the voice back to the victims. Certainly, you know, to those who haven't had justice, to Kathy and Joyce, and those that are still unsolved homicides being looked at properly. And then, of course, to the victims who are still alive. I guess some of them are in mediation. Is that right? They're still in mediation at the moment. But I don't know how much further the case will go in terms of, I guess it comes down to compensation, whether the Catholic Church admit to any of the things that have happened. Some of them have received compensation, some of them haven't. I mean, it seems to take an incredibly long time, but sorry and an acknowledgement goes a very long way, doesn't it, in these cases?
Yeah, and the Catholic Church has a bullet point by bullet point denial of ever knowing anything was wrong at all. So even though they do seem to be paying some of the victims, they're certainly not taking any responsibility for what happened. And even though, you know, Keough is now closed, Seton Keough School has closed, and I'm sure that they hope that all of these cases are closed too and that nobody else will come forward. But I'm just remembering what Marilyn, Kathy's sister, said, that there needs to be a world, there needs to be a place that we live in where people want to see something done. And I agree.
Absolutely. And I think that what's great at the end is that Abby says that whoever murdered Sister Kathy got away with it, but Gemma came through and said she thinks it will be solved and that she won't rest. So that is kind of the thematic, you know, thing that glues everything together. These women are the ones that pulled all this together, that created the ripple effect, that got the word out to the families and friends and the survivors, and because of that, now the world knows.
That's right.
What was going on in Keough, the disgusting mess that they allowed to happen, and the, you know, the crimes they allowed to be committed right under their friggin' roofs and under their crucifixes.
And we'll shine light on it. And I 100% believe the truth will always out eventually. And, you know, there's a lot of darkness here, but there's also a lot of light. And we just have to keep on shining light in those areas. And I pay tribute to all of the victims, you know, and to you, Lisa, and to Jim. Thank you for sharing your experiences. And, you know,
you,
I think together we're faster and keeping others safe. And the victim's voice, of course, has been absolutely at the heart of everything that we do. And everything that we have experienced is an important part of that too. So paying tribute to Gemma and Abby and to Ryan White, who had the courage to make this documentary, because we have to remember there were law enforcement professionals who wanted anonymity because they were so concerned for their own safety. So it does come at risk at times.
Well, that was another compelling episode that we talked about of The Keepers. And I will ask you one question, Lisa, because this is more in your bailiwick. Why The Keepers? Why that name? Why do you think they chose that name for this particular documentary series?
Right. I think they called it The Keepers because Abby and Gemma and people like them are the keepers of the flame of hope. They are the keepers of the story. They are the keepers who keep going to find justice. But I think it's the keepers of the flame of hope that something good will happen out of all of this.
See, I thought it was the opposite. Oh. I thought it was that the church and the administrators and the Monsignors were the keepers of the secret.
Oh.
That they kept this secret all these years, and these very heroic or sheroic women, Abby and Gemma, actually got them to reveal some of their secrets. So that's what I was thinking, but could be both.
Either way, it could be both. And yeah. I'm sure somebody out there knows. I'm sure Ryan White knows, but I think that both are valid for sure.
Well, if any of our listeners actually have a connection to the show and can tell us the answer to that question, we'd love to hear it.
Well, you can Google it. You can Google it, and it says the Keepers director, Ryan White, told The Wrap that the title actually came from a conversation between Jean, who's one of the victims in the documentary we've spoken about, coming forward accusing Father Maskell, but it actually came from her. Jean said, "We are the keepers of the secret, and I knew that had to be the title," White said. Obviously, it has other meanings. One other meaning was the idea of gatekeepers, the theory that people in position of authority and power are able to decide what we as the populace know or don't know, or whether survivors of abuse are validated or not. I also liked the institutional meaning of the keepers. And that's from his own mouth, so...
All right,
guys, so that's it for this episode of Real Crime Profile.
If you like our podcast, there are a few things that you can do. You can take 2 minutes and go to Apple Podcast and leave us a 5-star review. You can also check out all Real Crime Profile offers and promotion and our sponsors in our show notes. Another thing you can do is go over to Facebook and like our Facebook page. And one last thing is please tell all your friends, family and colleagues about us and spread the Real Crime Profile word. Thank you so much for listening to us. We really appreciate you.
Real Crime Profile is produced and edited by Paul Francis Sullivan. Sound engineered by Terrell Parham. Music composed by Simba Tsumba. Logo art by Jim Clementi. Real Crime Profile is produced by XG Productions and distributed by Wondery.
For advice and support if you're experiencing stalking in the UK, you can contact Paladin National Stalking Advocacy Service on 0203 866 4107, or you can go on the website www.paladinservice.co.uk. If you're experiencing domestic violence, call the National Domestic Violence Helpline free phone 0800 2000 247. In the US, if you're experiencing domestic abuse and need advice, safety, shelter or counselling, call Genesis, the 24-hour hotline, 214-946-4357, or go on their website, www.genesisshelter.org, or the domestic violence hotline on 800-799-7233.